Welcome back, everybody, to the Full Tank Motorcycle Podcast. We've just been on a few like press trips and stuff, haven't we, Tim? So
yeah, I can dive in on them, yeah, and explain my press trip for once. It's fun. I'm always just hearing about you jetting off to lovely places, Dubai being one.
Well, I'm not sure I count that as a lovely place.
Fair news, yeah. I was quite happy, actually. I said to you, and I was quite happy to hear that it's not somewhere that I'd necessarily need to visit because it seems quite expensive.
Yeah, we were out on the Ducati Diavel V4 launch a few weeks ago. I've already done like a Q&A episode. So if you want to know all about the bike and all the ins and outs and the specific questions that people submit, I mean, the specificity of some of the audience questions, especially when I asked for them on YouTube, is something to behold, Tim. Like, people really get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, they really do. It's a kind of useful thing, I suppose, to put that out before you go on the press trip as well, because then you know, I guess, what you need to ask
yes.
the guys that are launching, right?
True, although I wouldn't dare put my hand up in a press briefing and ask, like, some of the stuff. Like, there are questions like, would a part from a 2016, you know, of this bike right. fit if you tried to put it on there? Like maybe if you bodge it, I'm like, you know, that's not really what I'm there for, like to hack the bike up. And but yeah, anyway, if you want to know all about the bike, then listen back a few episodes and there's one all about the Diavel V4. But just from a trip perspective, it was super interesting. I've never been to the UAE before. It really is. You just get off the plane, come out the airport, get in the van, and it's just skyscrapers and then desert after that. And then we were in this remote hotel on the top of a mountain, which was quite spectacular. It had this Pikes Peak style road up and down it, which we got to ride, which was incredible. But there's not a great deal else there. I guess you can go camel riding and dune buggy in, and then you can go shopping. But
I think it seems like one of those places where you can't wander around it. So there's places where, you know, if you went to, say, France or Spain or whatever, you know, out of your hotel, you're like, do you know what? I'm just going to walk around and see what the local area is like. And maybe I'll find a nice bakery or something or a coffee shop or, you know, river or whatever. But with Dubai, there's plenty to do, but you have to book it or you have to be in the know.
Basically, yeah. No boozing either on that trip, just to respect the local customs.
It's probably a good thing though, I would say, based on the one I did in Spain where they're just giving you alcohol the night before and you're like, I do need to wake up tomorrow. And
you've got to definitely limit yourself. I will add as well, I don't know if they said the same on the trip you're on, but if there is wine with dinner before or a couple of beers, there's always the threat of random breathalyzer tests in the morning. Did they say that on your trip?
They didn't. I'm glad I didn't drink much anyway, but
I think they could do without, you know, people being tanked, but it was quite, I actually quite liked the fact on that trip that it was booze free, like absolutely 100%, because you know, you got a lot done. I was pretty productive and got some decent sleep for once, which you don't always when you're traveling and you're in a, like, you know, hotel room unfamiliar bed, you know. It was an interesting trip. I mean, incredible road. I can see why they hosted it out there, but I'm not in a massive rush to go back to the UAE. The bike was amazing though, absolutely rapid. In fact, now's probably a good point at which to talk about the fact that you went and saw the Diavel V4 after that trip, wasn't it? But in London at the kind of UK unveiling.
Yes, so arguably less exciting than riding the bike on a purpose-built road.
Still good though.
No, it was really good. And actually, a really nice surprise was that it was in the tippity top of the Gherkin in London, which I've not been in before.
The bell end.
Yeah, literally. And I was calling it that. And then I sort of thought maybe I should stop because they were all suited and booted. There was a dress code, which I did not hear about.
Sorry, mate. I think I was meant to tell you about that.
I reread the email and actually saw it in there. Yeah. Don't worry about it. I still looked fantastic. So yeah, I got to speak to the guys and they were talking mainly about the fact that it's won a design award.
Yeah. So Tim got to speak to both the product manager and one of the lead designers about how it's been, you know, designed. And so we'll let that interview play out now. It's about 10 to 15 minutes of pure, beautiful Italian accent.
That's true. That's just mine.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me. Love the presentation upstairs. It's a spectacular bike. You did it justice as well. I have to ask the first question actually to you, Andrea. Was it stressful at all drawing live for everybody upstairs?
Of course it was stressful.
Yeah.
Because usually, as a designer, we enjoy the drawing alone with music. Okay. Now we isolate ourselves in order to be creative and falling down in our environment.
Yeah.
So this has been the first time that we try to introduce this kind of format.
Yeah.
But I hope the people enjoying this kind of new feature.
It showed it, yeah. It showed it and explained it perfectly, I think, yeah. The design between the two. So, question for you, Stefano, in terms of the technical difficulties making this bike, difficulties may be too strong a word, were there any hard parts to change from the 1260 to the V4? Were there any that stand out as a difficult area to change?
Well, this bike has been completely redesigned in comparison with the other 1260. The toughest job was to reduce the weight. This was our main target at the beginning, so every single part we wanted it to be lighter than the previous one. This is not an easy task because, you know, every time you have to be better, better, and better in order to reduce the weight of each single part. And at the end, the new engine is amazing. The V4 Gran Turismo is an amazing engine. But I really do think that the things that you perceive most when you ride this bike in comparison with the previous one is in the weight reduction. 13 kilos less is something that changes completely the riding performance of this bike. It makes this bike closer to a monster, for example, to a sport naked bike than to a cruiser, because it is so nimble, because it's so agile when you change direction that you really almost do not recognize the previous Delta 60 on this bike.
And the weight savings, is it across the entire bike? There's no one specific area?
Yeah. If you want to throw down 13 kilos, you have to reduce each single part. Obviously, general perspective, you have 5 kilos less in the engine, 8 kilos that are from the chassis and the rest of the bike. Obviously, eliminating the trellis frame and instead of it having an aluminium monocoque frame changes and reduces the weight a lot, 5 kilos only in that. Then we have the reduction also in many other parts, but the main weight reduction are from weight engine and the chassis.
So with the chassis, when does the decision come to get rid of the trellis frame in view of something else? Does that come with the design or does that come with planning?
Of course, the monocoque was born with the Panigale 1199. So it's a kind of solution and technology that now is part of our DNA. From a technical point of view, the main reason is the reduction of the weight.
Okay.
A monocoque against the trellis, there is no doubt. Monocoque really can reduce a lot the kilo, the weight. And then, of course, in terms of design, change completely the approach in the main part of the bike. So yes, both of them, but maybe the most important reason is the weight.
Then the monocoque frame is also much more compact. You know, so in terms of design, it changes completely the proportion of the front part of the bike. In order to have a connection with the V4 Gran Turismo engine, where the V4 Gran Turismo engine is perfectly coupled with the monocoque frame. So this is the perfect couple, let me say. We have already experienced this couple in a platform that this platform comes from the platform of the Multistrada V4, because also the Multistrada V4 has the monocoque frame with the V4 Gran Turismo. So obviously we have changes the dimensions, the proportion and so on, but it comes from that platform, so it's a perfect couple. V4 Gran Turismo plus monocoque frame.
So what was the reason for the Gran Turismo engine? Obviously this performs differently from the Street Fighter or from the Panigale. So you don't need so much of that high rush, right?
Yeah, currently now we have the V4 engine platform, that is a platform where Ducati has invested, is investing and will invest a lot of resources, because we really think it's our engine for the future for our top of range models, okay? And obviously now we have two different V4 engine. We have the Desmos Elci Stradale, that is the perfect engine for super sporty bikes, so Panigale and Street Fighter. And the V4 Gran Turismo, that is the perfect platform for all the other bikes. So, Multistrada V4, Diavel V4, and in the future also other models. We really think that it's the most enjoyable engine, the V4 Gran Turismo, for the non-professional racing usage, okay? So it's so enjoyable in terms of smoothness, regularity, very regular from very low RPM, with a very flat torque curve. It's so enjoyable. And obviously in a bike like the Diavel or the Multistrada, you do not need to go so much over 10,000 RPM. So the V4 Gran Turismo is the perfect balance for that kind of bikes.
With design, when you're designing a bike like this, where the designs are allowed to make a lot more kind of extreme decisions, is it more fun to design a bike where you've got less restrictions?
Of course, in this kind of bike, where the design is one of the main reason of purchasing, of course we have somehow more power, so we can really push in order to find a really unusual solution, for example, the tail light.
Yes.
So, from the creative point of view, is more enjoyable. But of course, other kind of bike like the Panigale, for example, the challenge, and is a nice aspect of that bike, the challenge is to really to create a new design, push with the design, but fitting the extremely performance that we want with that bike.
Okay.
So, are two different kind of challenge, but anyway, nice and yes, really emotional to do.
It must be a delicate balance keeping the design language of the old version when you're bringing in the new, between the two. It's a compromise, I suppose, between designing something that's completely different and keeping enough of the old bike that it has the same form. So that must be a bit of a challenge. With this bike as well, you mentioned that it was started from the rear wheel almost, was the sort of the jumping off point, the starting point. Is that a usual thing for design as well? Do you start with one particular aspect and then build out from there?
Yes, I think happened, yes. For example, one really important aspect for the Multistrada, for example, was of course the ergonomy and the possibility to have a really, performant ergonomy for off-road riding, for road riding. So. Every bike has one or two key elements to keep over the top and to use as reference to design all the rest. Yes, can happen, yes.
And did you get much influence external from bikes, from the automotive world, for things like the tail light, for the exhausts? It seems like you've drawn on inspiration from outside of even motorbikes and cars. You were saying about as well, the stance is that of a runner, right? Which I really love the analogy that it looks like a runner ready to start. So are there some areas specifically on this that you drew inspiration from something external?
Yes, of course we take inspiration not only in the automotive world, because otherwise the risk is to create more or less always the same idea, no?
Yeah.
That is the risk. So, of course, we take inspiration from other worlds. So, for example, the exhaust comes from aeronautic world, for example. The thought behind the approach about all this volume that are, I can say, every volume has a really strong impact, but they work together. They can remind, for example, the Iron Man metal protection. So, of course, we take inspiration from every word that can give us something nice to develop.
The comics world is for the Diavel. The Diavel has always been, you know, the Batman motorcycle, you know. But I remember a nice story of one of our dealers that when he first saw this new Diavel before and he saw the rear light, you see the shape, the LEDs, and he said, okay, Diavel has always been the Batman motorcycle, but in this case, this is the Spider-Man motorcycle, you know, yes. Venom face, you know?
Yeah, I see that.
But it was something that we didn't think about it, is Ducati, but then now it comes out that it looks like a Venom face, you know?
Are you excited to find out what other people make of this? And like you say about the Spider-Man influence, where some people tell you something that you didn't realize or see, is that that's got to be an exciting part of launching any bike, right? Waiting for that paper.
Absolutely. It's always very, very exciting because starting from the very first moment when we show, for example, as a preview, our new motorcycles to our dealers, for example, they come out with opinions that we didn't expect. That always happens. And above all, when we launch the bike to the general public, it always happens that they find out things that we didn't expect and we didn't think. So for us, feedbacks are always super welcome and are very interesting. So,
thank you very much, gentlemen. Lovely to meet you. Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
Lovely stuff, Tim. Very nice to hear that. And what do you make of the bike yourself, seeing it in person?
It's nice, I have to say. So it's a weird one. You know, when the first Diavel came out and then the X Diavel, and I've seen that obviously around, and it looked something special to me. But there is a really weird thing that happens when they bring out a new version of it, where instantaneously the old version looks old.
Yeah.
So I was looking at, like, you know, what the originals were sort of going for, obviously, because I was trolling through Auto Trader straight after that, because they hooked me. So just out of curiosity, and I was seeing the older versions, and I have to say, it doesn't look dated, but it does look of a sort of, I guess, different generation, different era. And the new one to me is, yeah, pretty spectacular. I mean, in terms of looks, I don't think there's an awful lot I would change on it, for the arrogance of me, like I'm a designer. But honestly, going around the whole bike, even sort of nitty gritty bits, I know you quite like the taillight section. I love that as well.
Yeah.
It is a little sort of, it does split an audience to a certain degree, I think. But for me, it's very eye catching. And the indicators on the front as well. I remember you mentioned them being sort of above
the handlebars. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think even that sort of looks quite nice on closer inspection.
The only sort of downside, I suppose, is the like the rear cylinder bank is sort of hidden up under the seat, but they put like a plastic fake. I can see why people don't love that compared to the old one where it's got these beautiful machined engine covers.
Sure.
So the engine itself is not necessarily a beaut, but the rest of the bike, I think, just it's certainly like what you would call a head turner, I think, you know.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say it's a head turner, yeah.
Yeah. And also, I was just thinking as well, you were rubbing shoulders with quite a few celebs at that event, weren't you?
Yeah, a couple. Well, the first one I spotted when I walked in was Richard Hammond.
Mm, did you chat to him?
No. I've got nothing to say, man. I stand neither. There and I'm like, I sort of rack my brain. I'm like, right, hold on. Maybe I could, oh no, I can't talk about that. And then I just sort of keep ticking off, no, definitely not. No subject matter. So I just sort of don't go over and say hi. I could just walk over and say, love your work, you know, lovely to meet you kind of thing. That would be enough for me, I suppose. But
just say, love you. Leave it just, cut, yeah. Sure. Well, this is why I said rubbing shoulders, because... like, that's quite literal. Maybe you did bump into them and that was it.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I literally, you just spot, it's funny because if you're not expecting, then you sort of spot from a distance and you, I don't know, it's obvious that you've spotted someone. It's not quite a double take, but very nearly. And then, Foggy was there as well because he was, I think he's linked in some ways, sort of ambassadorial role because they were talking about obviously his racing days.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen him at a few events as well. But he was there. I think Heston Blumenthal was there as well. But I might be...
just maybe could just have been a guy who looked...
yeah, just a bald guy, glasses.
Well, that could be me, wait.
It was you. There you so no, there was a few famous faces there. And like I say, everyone was very smartly dressed. So even if they weren't celebs, they looked like it for a day.
Lovely stuff. And I think I wholeheartedly agree with your approach there. I'm not the sort of person who can just walk up to a celebrity and just kind of say hi. And me and Tim both used to work at the BBC. That's how we met. And so... coming in and out of there, you'd see celebrities all the time. You know, your Damian Lewis kind of level, quite Tom Hiddleston, is it? I want to say Huddleston. Hiddleston, you know, a couple of like big names like that. But I would never just walk up and ask for a picture. But the closest I came was in the lobby for the BBC and I saw Ronnie O'Sullivan, who I just absolutely love. I think he's amazing. Love everything about him. Love snooker.
Did you get a picture?
No. I was like literally had my hand in my pocket on my phone, like, should I? this is the one time that I'm maybe going to do it. Yeah. But then I was like, nah, he's the sort of personality as well.
Well, it's professionalism, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And if they come to the BBC, they're there to work and they don't expect people in the BBC to be, starstruck and ask for a selfie because, they're exactly, trying to just get mate.
The day. Yes. But anyway, that was your most recent... Oh, no, it wasn't. That was your previous press engagement, let's say.
That was, yes, prior, yeah.
Soon after... You're out on the CF Moto launch, which I we got the invite and I was like, I can't do that one. It clashes with the street triple. So there is a pecking order, I'm afraid, of bikes where you have to prioritize certain stuff.
Hang on. This is the first time hearing about it. Did I get the hand me off?
It's not a hand me off because I still wanted to do it because I think the bikes look quite impressive. And also like the roads out there, the scenery that you were shooting in look great. But I was like, well, I just physically can't be in two places. And it's probably the first time that I've said, what about Tim? I'd love it if you went on that. And so a big shout out to them for kind of trusting us. Tim's made quite a bit of content for the Motobob channel in the past, and it's as good as, if not slightly better than my videos, which is, on the one hand, when you send them through, I'm like, this is really good. And he's put a bit of effort in with the edit. And on the other, I'm like, oh, damn, I need to get like up my game a bit. But so it's great that they kind of saw that, trusted, and I've seen the initial content that you got from it, and I think it looks great. So... But I thought it'd be great just to kind of recap on that trip and maybe tell us a bit about, my question is like, do we now think that Chinese motorcycles, Chinese built bikes are on a par, let's say, with, what would you say was the equivalent? Japanese equivalent maybe, or?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, are they, I suppose you've got the Japanese end of the spectrum, you've got the American, you've got the European. So does it sort of play with those?
But in that sort of like... $7,000.
I see what you mean.
Kind of 700s, 800s. Really, it's like you're looking at the, they're making the KTMs now, the 790s. Yeah. So really, you're looking at MT07s and the Z650, and then also maybe like the Trident, but that's built in Thailand.
Yeah.
But to Triumph standards, they say. Kind of just thinking about those as the direct competition for these bikes. I mean, actually, which bikes did you actually ride? That would be a good start, or the ones you reviewed at least.
Pretty much. So in terms of reviewing it, I was on the 700 and the 800. They were my focus because for both of us, that was most of our sort of curiosity was aimed at that because I've not ridden a larger capacity Chinese bike. Chinese made, Chinese designed, whatever it is. So that was my sort of curiosity. The weird thing was, and I don't know if I told you this, but there was the sort of surprise of the day for me and for a lot of the guys actually out there was the smaller capacity bikes, the 300 in particular.
Right.
So in terms of what we rode, we were on the 300 SR, I believe. So it's like their, it's just a sports bike, if you like. So kind of like a Yamaha R3, is it?
Yeah, okay. That looks quite tasty, that.
Yeah, and it's pretty looking, I have to say, but I really, really wasn't expecting big things from it. And when my turn came, because they brought a lot of bikes, probably too much to fit into one day, to be honest. But what it did give was a really nice contrast between them. And like I say, everyone kind of had their favorites going in. And I was like, yeah, fine, I'll jump on the 300. And the section of road we were on as well was fantastic. We were just going up. In fact, all of it was fantastic. There literally wasn't a bad piece of road to be seen. But that bike, because it was so small, everyone loved it. It was kind of charming because it was so small, you felt like you could wring its neck. Like you could get it to 100%. Whereas, because the roads were, they were literally just hairpin after hairpin. They were super tight. One of the tightest roads I've ever been on. So when you're on an 800 cc bike, going into that, you have to measure it, you have to kind of you know drop down, pick your line and your speed correctly, and hope that you did, otherwise you have to sort of readjust mid corner, and sometimes that's just, it doesn't feel as consistent. It's a bit frustrating when you have to compromise your line, let's say. Whereas with the 300, you could just bomb it into a corner, yank on the brakes, it gives enough feel, it's light enough that it's not really going to get too out of shape. And then just throw it into a corner and pretty much just hold the throttle wide open the whole way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, pin it.
And it was great. It was so good for that. So that, I think, for everyone was a kind of a big surprise. And it was also sort of smoother than I was thinking. And I was wondering where the jump would come, when it would be noticeable that the quality had improved. Because obviously they've worked with other partners in the past. And they have obviously based a lot of their designs off of previously made bikes.
Yeah.
Engines specifically. But so, for example, the 650 is based on the Kawasaki engine.
The Kawasaki.
The Kawasaki.
Kawasaki.
The Kawasaki engine. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's the, you know, the Z650. It might even parallel be a little twin. Before that. So, like, yeah exactly. ER6, that sort of setup. So they're engines you're familiar with, and I was expecting at some point, especially when you know that the 800, for example, when you realize that bike is closely linked with the 790, KTM 790, I was expecting, because this is, I think, one of their newest bikes, if not their newest bike sort of release, that there would be a big step up in quality. In my head, I was sort of, that was one of the questions at least that I had.
Right.
And I have to say, it wasn't as noticeable a transition or like a leap. It wasn't like a step up to the 800. It was just that, as you'll find, you know, with any other brand, if you go from their naked street bike to their big flagship touring bike or whatever, there is a difference. And you can tell, you know, when you jump on, say, a GS compared to an F900, there's going to be a step up, isn't there?
A few more bits and pieces, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And it's just everything gets a bit more ironed out. It's a bit more cushy and plush.
But do you say that as like, as in the smaller capacity bikes were impressive or the larger capacity bikes?
Yes.
Okay.
No, oh yeah, it's that way around. So rather than it being like, it means that the 800s were less impressive than I was expecting, it's more that the smaller capacities were more impressive than I was expecting.
Right.
Like I say, specifically the 300. We didn't have the 450, which they do. We had, next step up was the 650 NK, which stands for naked. So that is similar to, you know, ER6F or Kawasaki Z650 or, well, insert bike name here, I guess. Similar, I guess. You could sort of compare it to, say, the Hornet. I would say the Hornet probably is more refined. Yeah, their 650 NK was another surprise, because, again, so I started on the 700, and a lot of us did because they had a few of those. And then we jumped on the 650 and we were like, you know, expecting the 700 to be the one that sort of blows our socks off.
Yeah.
And it was actually sort of, you jump back and you're like, wow, that's the 650, weirdly, and we did mention this on the day, was a little bit smoother, probably because it's been out for longer. I don't know, maybe there's some teething problems with the 700, but it was a bit smoother.
On the throttle, though?
Yeah, than the 700. And basically, they've adjusted, I say, it's the same engine in the 650 and the 700s. They've bored it out, made it a larger capacity.
So it's a 180 crank in those?
I believe so, yeah.
So it's got more of that chugging feel, whereas the 800s have got the cross-plane 270 kind of. Ah, okay.
So the 700, I think I'm right in saying, is a larger capacity, but the same, you know, basics in terms of the engine as the 650. But when I was on the 700, we set off, and just doing the town stuff before we got to the mountain roads, I was just playing with the throttle to see what it had and how smooth the power delivery was, and, you know, where it meets its sort of peak revs and stuff like that, or peak power, or nearly shot into the bike in front of me, because it was like, oh yeah, no, it's okay. Got to 7,000 revs and it went, way! And really, it got quite giddy, let's say, at 7,000 revs. And it redlines, I think, at like 8 or 9, roughly, and then goes all the way up to sort of 10. So you've not got a lot past 7,000, but it just hits this weird sort of spike where you're like, fucking hell, where was that? Like, a few thousand revs before. So it's, and it wasn't that smooth a transition. In my head, I sort of likened it to the transition that you'd get from the 800 VTEX, for example.
Okay.
You know, when they open the extra valves and you get that surge. It was that kind of surge, and it was an odd one. And I was like, if I got that in a corner, I think it would be disconcerting. I'd rather have that, you know, on a straight. If it happens when I'm not expecting it, it's going to wrong foot me. And again, I'll have to just adjust my line and it'll frustrate me. I have to say, didn't notice it at all when we got onto the faster roads and it opened up.
Yeah, I got you.
So it wasn't really a problem. It was only on the straights, and it was only because I wasn't expecting it. And I think it's only in terms of the mapping. And we mentioned it to them, and I'm sure, because it is a while before they're going to be like fully released, you know, in large capacity in the UK. That's the sort of thing they definitely could tweak and improve on them, because it's
totally
just
that could be a different map. Yeah,
exactly. And that'd be an easy thing to do. And it was also, I should definitely point out, the Sport that I started on.
Right.
So they have three versions that we had for the day. They had the 700 CLX Sport, Heritage, and the Adventure, which is their scrambler style.
Yeah.
And on the Sport, that's where it was really noticeable. When I got on the scrambler, that disappeared. It was obviously mapped differently because it's a scrambler.
Ah,
it should be.
Okay. And it was not just you that found this. There was a few other.
No, and that's the thing. So I was like, because, you know, I don't know. I'm green as grass. So I was sort of, I didn't want to sort of take for granted. I sort of gone and I mentioned it to a few people. I was like, just let me know what you think of that. Like, to me, it felt a bit this. And then once they sort of confirmed that they felt it as well, I was like, okay, good. I wasn't just like imagining it.
Who else was out on the trip with you then?
There was a few really good group as well. That was really nice. There was a lot of camaraderie and support and stuff from the guys, and no competitiveness at all, despite the fact that I was comfortably the slowest in the entire group.
Oh, right.
And I was happy with my lot at the back, because normally we set off and there's a bit of a sort of teething time where you sort of work out where you sit in the sort of pecking order, or if you're holding people up or if they're holding you up, and you just resettle. And we set off, and I was second to back, and a guy called Dave was behind me.
I know Dave.
And yeah, really nice guy, right?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He was like on the Hornet trip last time with me, I think. Yeah.
So motorcycle, sport and leisure, Dave. Yeah. And he was, fucking good rider as well. So he was behind me. And then obviously at a certain point, I was like, no, I'm holding him up. So I waved him on, and he was fine from that point onwards, and I didn't really see his tail again for a few corners. So he was at least sort of two corners ahead of me. So yeah, but the group was, like I say, there was zero competitiveness to it at all. It was all kind of like, you know, you could openly sort of go, oh, you know, that corner, you were really quick around that one. What's the sort of, what am I missing? What's my technique? Or, you know, you were sat behind me. What do you reckon based on my riding? So yeah, there was Dave, as I mentioned. There was Andy, who was there for Carol Nash, I think he was working on behalf of, but he freelances. And then there was Dan from MCN.
Yeah.
And username Kate, you've met username Kate as well, right?
Kate's great, yeah. She's someone I spoke to about perhaps coming on the podcast at some point. So we should. I did think about doing it for this, but I've been very disorganized lately, but I'm sure we'll get the chance. But
I think, she was fantastic. Proper sort of blunt northern kind of demeanor, which I really, really liked. Quite funny as well. So
we need a bit of blunt northernness on the pod. So
yeah.
Oh, great. Well, it sounds like an amazing trip, and the bikes are quite cool. Yeah, so you've got the review of the CLX Heritage. Is it the one that was in the review, or is it the Adventure?
So that was the Adventure.
Yeah.
Which was my preference of the, to sort of get back to them. That one was definitely smoother on the throttle. That was a good, great, fun bike. And I sort of, if you pitch that against what it's playing against, I suppose, I can't really see it having that much competition, because it's not quite like, say, the Ducati Scrambler.
The Moto Marini, surely, right? The Moto Marini 6.5 Scrambler.
Yes.
Same engine.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's pretty much it, yeah.
That's its closest competition, because if you compare it to, say, a Ducati Scrambler, they're not the same. And in terms of like the Icon or the standard Ducati Scrambler compared to this one, I'd rather actually take this one off road.
Also, the Scrambler's 10 grand now. Remember, like, the price has gone up massively. So
hugely. And then if you compare it to, say, the Benelli as well, but that's smaller capacity. So again, doesn't really sort of compare to it. So it was good. It had good stand-up proportions. It was comfortable to stand up on. The fact that it's a scrambler was, I mean, it's my comfort zone. I was much more comfortable on that than I was on the Sport. I mean, the Sport I was fine on, but when I jumped on that, it just all felt familiar, because you've got that huge leverage on the bars and stuff. You've got that bigger front wheel, so it's a bit, you know, slower, more predictable in a corner. You've got super cushy suspension, which you can just, you know, squidge into on a corner.
Yeah.
Like that a lot. And then obviously the power was a little bit smoother. Like I said, it was definitely mapped, so it was a little bit easier to get on with. So that was a good bike. And then obviously we jumped on the 800. So my last bike back to the hotel was the 800.
So these are adventure style bikes, right? There's three in the lineup.
So these are adventure, yeah. Which, a bit of the strange thing to me was that they're not really pitched. I mean, none of the bikes, or a lot of that market, let's say, are more of a tourer than an actual off-road explorer.
Mm-hmm.
If you compare it, you know, if you're thinking of like Tigers and stuff like that, or not so much the Africa Twin, that is pretty much good for off-road, but obviously it's big and heavy, so it's not as good as the smaller capacity ones. The closest in terms of like being really capable off-road are the KTMs. But like I say, most of them are...
Tenere?
Tenere as well. Yeah, exactly. That is definitely pitched for off-road, isn't it? So they've got their kind of specialty. This is definitely more on the road bias. I don't even know if it had an off-road mode. It had two riding modes, I think. So you had, I think it's called Street and Rain, but basically, you know, like full power and then moderated.
Dialed back a bit, yeah.
Definitely more focused at road. Similar in terms of sharing some DNA with the 790, which I've not tried the Adventure, but I've tried the 790 Duke, so you know I know the engine well. And it sits really well on this bike. It's got some great little additions and some kind of odd ones, actually, because the 700s had like cruise control on them and stuff. And I'm like, other bikes in its bracket don't generally have that. And it's odd where they've kind of put the star parts, if you like the fancier parts. Like on the Sport, they've thrown like Brembo Stylemas on it.
What?
Yeah, no. And I'm like, wow. That's not normally what other brands do, but they've given it like some proper trick brakes.
What about the suspension? Let me have a look. That looks kind of crazy. Stylemas. My take on that perhaps is like, they know probably that Chinese bikes are going to be a little bit a disadvantage to start just because of the reputation. Yeah. So stuff like the Moto Marini, which I've ridden, you've got the Italian brand, which is great that the CF Moto doesn't have, but ultimately people are going to know it's Chinese built. And so the standard features in terms of tech, like the TFT dash is great. I think you do get cruise control on that and you get like connectivity and stuff. And I think also the finish on that bike with little like Marini logos everywhere, like they've really gone to town in terms of making it look a cut above the price point. And I just wonder if that is a response to like, or a way of counteracting it is like, well, you can get quite a lot more spec for your money if you don't feel like you're getting the build.
And also, if you're not 100% sure, if you go into it and you don't know whether to trust a brand, if they throw in names that you definitely do trust, you know, if they slap some Brembos on there, you know they're good brakes. There's no two ways about it. It's not like they've got fake Brembos. They are Brembos.
How do you know? Maybe they got them off Alibaba.
So they've, but like you say, it gives you reassurance and confidence. And the other thing to do that, obviously, is a belief. So part of the reason for this trip was that they're explaining KTM and managing their distribution elsewhere in the world.
Yeah.
So they've had a partnership for about 10 years and they have been distributing KTMs. So CF Moto have been helping KTM distribute in China and vice versa. Now KTM is helping them. So they're setting up a dealer connections and stuff like that and system for it. And because of that, you know, you've got a bit more confidence in the brand then, don't you? If you don't know them or if you've never heard of them before, they've got a 4-year warranty, all that sort of stuff. You're like, it's starting to look pretty appealing, I have to say. And especially if you look at the 800, and that was the last bike I went on. So we were coming back down the mountain. It was a really comfortable place to be. And there were some very, very tight hairpin corners going downhill, which normally aren't my strong suit. Those are the sort of corners that I would be, you know, going in quite reserved on. But I had a lot of confidence in that bike, I have to say. And it has lean sensitive ABS and stuff, which again, I know from KTM works really well. You can put a lot of faith into that system. And I did. Luckily for me, because it was nothing sort of wrong-footed me or unnerved me going into kind of unknown corners. You know, you don't know how tight they are. If they tighten up on you and you've picked your speed wrong, you might have to adjust brakes mid-corner. So having that there is a huge reassurance. And it was good fun. And it was the best bike of the day, but it wasn't, like I say, a huge dramatic step up.
Yeah.
And it didn't shit on the other bikes of the day.
Exactly.
Basically. Yeah.
So it sounds like that was probably a 20-minute way of answering the question whether Chinese bikes are on a par with their peers now. Sounds like they're getting close.
I would say so. Yeah, I would say I was going there wanting to know whether it did or whether they stood up. And yes, I was pleasantly surprised.
I think the only thing is like long-term owner's reviews and stuff like that. But presumably this KTM partnership is only going to have a positive effect on CF Moto. They said they've got their KTM bods out there, like making sure that the build processes, this is the same approach Triumph took, you know, getting their kind of processes in place to make sure the quality control's as good. So but it'll still be interesting to see when people buy them, what are the owner's reviews like? What are the forum posts like? The stuff that, you know, YouTubers and people like myself can't really answer because it just, the economics of it don't really work. You can't put 10,000 miles on a bike. But that's the only thing I'd be keeping my eye out for. But hopefully we'll get a few. I've got the 790 Duke and 790 Adventure coming next month for review. So that'll be interesting as well to see how those feel. Maybe see if you can get a spin on one as well. Well, I have to try and hook that up. Yeah.
While it's still fresh in my mind, it'd be nice to compare the two.
Definitely. And then rounding off our little trip experiences, while you were on that, I was out on the street triple. So a day at Jerez or Jerez, if you want to. Well, you could say Jerez, couldn't you? If you were going pure British, like butchering. I never know which one to go for.
It looked good though, mate. That shot from your hotel was stunning.
Yeah, it was a great trip. Triumph always put on great events, and obviously, I think it's fair to say, great bikes. Like, there haven't been many bad ones recently, and certainly a street triple, you'd have to do something pretty drastic to mess it up, because it's just such a peach all round. And I was really impressed with it. I think, you know, the big takeaway on that bike, and again, we've got a Q&A podcast and video already live. I think it'll go live before this one. You know, so there's a lot more detail there, including some very specific specifics. But the kind of overall thing is, like, it is better than the previous gen. Not massively. If you own the previous gen, like, maybe demo one to see if you want to upgrade. Yeah, I wouldn't say it was night and day. Things like, they've made it more responsive in the handling with a 10 mil spacer on the shock to jack the back up. Yeah. So that affects the geometry, gets you up over the front a bit. But you could do that on the previous gen yourself. You just get a different shock and it'd be cheaper than probably upgrading. Yeah. But, you know, if you're looking for an all-round better bike, it's got an IMU now. It's got 7 more PS at the top. It's got, the new suspension situation. It's got Brembo style Emmas as well. And if you look at the RS for like 11 grand or 11 and a half with the fancy paint jobs, 11,295 for the basic paint job. Mm. I don't know. Going on the Diavel launch, I was like, that bike is incredible. But it's 23 grand. And so there's always a caveat, isn't there? It's like, it's incredible if you can afford it. And like, I know that 11,295 is still out of most people's reach, but, you know, it's more achievable, especially if you are someone who's willing to finance a bike, whether that's a good thing or not is a question of personal stance. But, I don't think 11,295 seems excessive. And what you get is like a bike that, you know, some of the people riding there, a lot of the journalists are ex-racers, and they're happy as anything on a street triple on the track, you know? So if they're happy, most people should be. Lots of top end to it, and loves to rev. And
Yeah, I've always said, like, I mean, my first take on it, and I think I probably borrowed it from somebody else, but that it's a hero maker. It's the sort of bike that even if you're an average rider, you can get on and kind of feel like you've had a good day. As opposed to trying to tame something that is specialist and far too close to that sort of cutting edge, you feel like it's got enough leeway, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not
like comfort for an average rider.
Yeah, it's not gonna spit you off or anything if you're riding it relatively sensibly. And then we had it on the road, and mate, that engine, you know, I love a triple. It made me want to get home. Yeah. I haven't ridden my Tiger 800 for ages, but I was like, I want to go home and ride my Tiger just because I love smooth, normal triples rather than I do like the T-plane on the Tiger, but the new Tiger 9 and 12.
Yes.
But yeah, that smooth mid-range, honestly, it was so great on the road. It sort of really allows you to rev it out on the track and experience what that's like. But also, the sort of fueling, the way the throttle is just so smooth. There's no lurchiness, even in sport mode or track mode. The sort of richness of that mid-range and the way it just, like, the quick shift is perfect. And they've tuned the sound as much as they can. And it's just it's fantastic.
I love the sound. They like the sound on them, because some people aren't massive fans of the sound of a triple.
What?
Or a Triumph triple in particular.
Mate, not having that.
They exist, mate. But I have to say, like, it doesn't sound that spectacular just going past you, I guess. I mean, there are some other bikes that sound better. Generally speaking, a twin always sounds better as the sort of third person, you know, if it was to roll past you. You're like, yeah, nice sounding bike. Triples, they sound okay, but it doesn't sound as good to, you know, the bystander. Whereas when you're on the bike and you're on the throttle, it sounds fantastic. Like, it's so encouraging. You just want to keep teasing that throttle and building the revs on them, I found, at least.
But the only sort of maybe reason you might not buy one is the sort of competition in that price area. So things like the Kawasaki Z900, the MT09, the 890 Duke, they're all quite a lot bigger in capacity. So they've got a lot more mid-range and torque and grunt. Mm-hmm. They make maybe 20 more newton meters of peak torque and make it about 2,000 or 3,000 RPM lower. So maybe in terms of real world gruntiness, they have a little bit more shove. But I think It'd be a very close run thing for me as to which I'd buy out of those. Almost certainly not the Z900, because that has the most on-off throttle chop I've ever experienced. Like, it is literally okay. Like, dung, mid-corner. You just give it a tiny, like, 0.1 of a mil of throttle, trying to really tease in smoothly. Yeah. It's like a real jolt. Same on the Z900 RS. I think you can get them remapped and it solves it, but I kind of feel like, why should I have to do that if I'm buying a brand new bike? NT09, incredible bike, bags of mid-range. Again, beautiful triple soundtrack, but it has kind of like the bars are very high on that bike. If you ever look at the risers.
Yeah, compared. I mean, they're both naked bikes, but one is definitely more on the sportier side, right? I don't want to say like a bigger supermoto sort of setup.
Exactly.
It's just more of a naked setup, I suppose. But yeah, you're more proud of the bike than you would be on a street triple.
Yeah, exactly. It's a much more sporty position on the... street triple. And the 890 Duke is probably the one that feels most similar in terms of like riding position, sportiness, quite a taut chassis. But I think the engines, like the massive, well, there's two massive differentiators with those two bikes. Clearly the parallel twin 270 crank in the 890 has a very different feel. And also the looks, like the street triple just looks fantastic now, especially in that red, the RS.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They tweak it so marginally each time, but every time you're like, yeah, that is an improvement.
Looks good to me.
It's subtle,
yeah.
But yeah, it looks pretty good.
So yeah, I think the NT09 would be a great bike if you just want to like razz around and you fancy a slightly comfier riding position. The 890, if you'd like a parallel twin and you want something that feels super sporty and like amazing to ride, but also it's quite garish to look at. Good for some people, maybe not others. I think the street triple's classy to look at, and the engine is classy as well. It's not as much of a hooligan, although, you know, they've shortened all the gear ratios, final drive ratios, and given it more throttle response. So I wouldn't say it's not, it can make you feel very juvenile. It'll power wheelie everywhere, you know, in second. Like, it also has a certain, slightly more luxurious feeling to me than like the 890.
I would say so. That's a really hard thing to define. I think the other thing for me with the 890 over it is the 890 is, I think they're probably very similar weights, but the 890 just feels really light. And when they call it a scalpel, it definitely is a scalpel. But what I found when I rode and previous versions, so not this newest street triple, but the street triple to me, I felt, what would I say? Again, it's this sort of consistency in a corner where I would hold truer to my line. Whereas with the KTM, because I knew I could adjust my line easily, I was kind of just mucking around all over the place with it mid-corner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I found myself tweaking it a lot more. What would I say? Not flighty. Like, it's not like it's uneasy or unsteady. It's, what would I say? I don't know. I'm sort of likening it to an animal, basically, where it's on high alert the whole time, right?
Yeah.
And it's, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
Very, very vague sort of, explanation of it. But yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I kind of came away from it thinking, fantastic bike. Definitely see why someone might buy one. If I had the money and I was looking for like an all-rounder on the road, certainly that would be on the shortlist.
Here's my question, actually, something I've always been curious of. Between that and, say, a speed triple, where would your money lie?
Street triple.
Mm. Okay.
Hands down, mate. I mean, the speed triple is cooler, like in some ways. Like, I love the RR. The looks of it are stunning. But when I had both the RS and RR, you just feel like you're not really using what it's capable of on the road, and it feels a bit dissatisfying. And then I can't use it on the track either. So for bragging rights and the cool looking bike, I think there's a case for it. Maybe if you're a great rider on the track, there's a case for it. Or if you're willing to risk life and your license on the road, then fine, you know, whatever, each to their own. But I think in terms of like getting something out of it from the track riding, and also something that you don't feel like is completely under stress. I mean, it is way too fast for the road if you like give it the full beans, but it doesn't feel like that all the time. I mean, that's partly why I love the Trident so much, like 80 horses or whatever, but you get some of that kind of triple vibe. But yeah, I think the street triple, but the price as well is just really in that sweet spot, and also the sort of the power level and the performance. It just feels like you've got, you know, Olin Shock, Brembo Stalima brakes, like, you know, the best of the best, but in this sort of power level that's not kind of completely bonkers. I know that might sound like a cop-out because a lot of people would get maybe a bit like bravado on the power numbers, but I think honestly, if I'm being honest with myself, like I can't really use a great deal more than...
No, completely. I agree. And my dad said this as well. When I was saying about the, you know, I told him about this 300 being the one that sort of was my pick of the day, or at least the one that maybe I had the most fun on. And it was, he was saying the same sort of thing. And you see it with like the Isle of Man TTs as well. Like they'll go on the bigger bikes, the thousands, and they'll jump on a 600. Mm. And they're not far off their pace, but they just can push it a bit further. Whereas you have to measure it, like you say, with the thousands. So if you push your threshold on a bigger capacity bike, it's always fun stepping down something, especially when it's capable as well, but stepping down in power, because you just feel like you've got more control and you're managing it a bit better on that one.
I always think it's like, I used to play a lot of Gran Turismo on PlayStation, and you know, like right at the beginning, you can only, you get like a small amount of credits and you can only buy like a really rubbish car, like a Nissan Micra. But you get really good, like just driving that car around a track. Yeah, like you get good at cornering speed and braking points. And if you do, like, you know, just go and buy like the most powerful car, you just hammer down the straights and then skid around the corner and, you know, then hammer down the next straight. And it's definitely like that to me. Like I really enjoy riding the sort of, because of my ability level, I think, you know. I enjoy, but I think it's like you say, it's true of anybody. You can really enjoy riding those lower powered bikes and focusing in on the basics. Even doing California Superbike School, actually, not last year, year before maybe, on the Ninja 650, although the riding position was a little bit too compromised. That was the thing. Like you're so like, even though it looks like a sports bike, your bum's so far down, the bars are so far up that you can't really get into any sort of like sporty riding position. But certainly like, I thought it would maybe feel a bit rubbish to ride, but there's nothing more fun, in my opinion, although you're not racing on a day like that. It's still pretty fun when you do go past someone on a really quick bike and you're on a Ninja 650 and you sort of like really trying to carry that speed through the corner. So pure joy. Anyway, I think that pretty much wraps it up for today. So many thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks for the recap, Tim, on those trips.
Thank you for sending me.
Hopefully we'll have some exciting new episodes to come soon. So yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next one.